I need to do a bit of recapping on yesterday and finishing off yesterday. So while you're taking that down, I'll do the recapping on the grounds that you can multitask in that regard. I was in a picture theatre watching those, you know, those slides that come up before the theatre starts, and they got out of sync, which was really funny. So you're advertising a restaurant at the same time as looking at a picture of the local hospital. And what fascinated, apart from the humour and everyone laughing, after a while I realised it actually was very good because I was able to take in both at the same time, which just shows the ability of the human mind, really, because it's just an average brain, but you can do two quite different things, totally unrelated things, at the same time. In fact, I worked out it most likely was intentional. I concentrated on the slides for the first time in my life, and the last. Now, let me recap on the tail end of the talk. The cultural war has led to confusion, especially on the subjects of love, sex and marriage. God guides us in our choices, but the guidance you've got to understand in terms of the big picture. You've got to fit in the text of any part of the scripture into the context of what the whole scripture is saying. And so the whole picture, the big picture of God's guidance is to bring everything, to unite everything under Christ. And part of that picture is marriage. For Christ and his bride is the essence of the marriage that he speaks about in the beginning of Genesis. And our marriage is in the image of that marriage, which is God's eternal plan, part of uniting everything under the headship of Jesus. But marriage is outlined to us all through the scriptures, and the marriage of Jesus to the church is there in the scriptures. And we're going to be looking at the scriptures on the subject of marriage, the marriage in love, sex and marriage. By the way, the order love, sex and marriage always worries me. You know, we should actually have the marriage, but love, marriage, sex doesn't actually run as nicely off the tongue, you know, and so that's why it is. It's like man and woman. Man and woman is the way to say it, not woman and man. Only people who say woman and man have never studied poetry. You just don't understand the rhythm of the language. They say, well, no, you've got to have man first. That sounds like it's patriarchal. Men come first. Well, what do you do with ladies and gentlemen? Ladies has to come first, doesn't it? Does that mean that that's matriarchy? You're ridiculous, you see. It's the rhythm of the language. You've got to learn how to say words. And the word man is a powerful preaching word. The word humankind is an appalling, it's a dreadful thing created by lunatics. Well, there's a perfectly good word called humanity, which we've had for centuries. If you're going to use it, at least use humanity rather than humankind. But humanity is not nearly as powerful rhetorically as man. That's a very strong word, you see. And so, little short... Anyway, I won't go on a bit. You get the point. Love, sex and marriage comes into the Bible throughout. But confusion abounds, I was saying yesterday, because of the sexual revolution. Now, the first half of the 20th century, it was the academics in all the disciplines undermining the Christian understanding of marriage. In the mid-section century, there were these underground movements taking place, such as I spoke of yesterday in terms of the Sydney Push, Sex and Anarchy and Anne Coombs' book on the life and death of the Sydney Push. And those underground movements of really degenerate people came to be in the mainstream in the early 1960s. And you can pick it up with the Beatles as good as any illustration of what it is, but you know, the Rolling Stones are the same. I mean, any number of them, depends who you, but the Beatles are the biggest name. Interesting, you ought to see the change in Australia. In 1959, here in Sydney, it was true across Australia, 150,000 people went out and heard Billy Graham preach. 1959. 1964, 150,000 people went out and heard the Beatles. That's the shift that took place in our period of time. It was very radical, very dramatic, and it caught the churches completely unawares. Because, well, previously they were degenerates on the fringe of society, although the fringe was the University of Sydney. And that's where all the lawyers, journalists, teachers were being trained for the City of Sydney in the 1950s, because that was the only university that was there, really. With apologies to the University of New South Wales, which at that stage was a tech college. Thank you. And so, once it became mainstream, then the fringe group fell away. But once it became mainstream, then in the 1970s, the feminists realised how appallingly they had been treated, and they really had been treated appallingly by the degenerates, and up rose the Gillard on her view of marriage, which I mentioned to you yesterday. You say, when I went to university, and she's in the 70s, started forming my political views of the world, we weren't talking about gay marriage as feminists, we were critiquing marriage itself, you see. Marriage came under question. In her own personal life, she goes on next one, I have a valuable lifetime commitment and haven't felt the need at any point to make that into a marriage. Here is a woman who is in charge of the federal government, which is in charge of marriage as a legal entity, and she does not believe in marriage. She didn't make that common knowledge, by the way, until after she'd left being Prime Minister. That was in her retirement speeches that she actually made it clear. She didn't believe in marriage at all, but she's in charge of the whole legislation of marriage. But where I stopped yesterday was the point there's other understandings that we've come to. See, where I'm coming to this understanding is by and large just reading the non-Christians on the subject. That's why we've moved away from the Bible, which is very irritating, but press on. Simon Zretta and Kate Fisher are two academics in England, no indication of Christianity in their understanding at all. Zretta is an academic at Cambridge University, I've forgotten which one Fisher is at, and they did a survey, oral history of old people. In the 1990s, they lined up all these old people, 300 or 400 of them. You can't move from oral history to statistical conclusions, but nonetheless, the oral picture was really quite striking, and it was striking to them because it was not what they were expecting. They asked these old people about their sex lives, and these were the people who were married 1918 through to the 1960s, before the kind of sexual revolution, and it turned out to be quite different to their expectation. They knew very little about sex before marriage. As they said, what was the point of learning about something you weren't going to do? Sex happened after marriage, and sex was of a different character. They really enjoyed their sex lives, which astonished people because they had no education in it, and yet they enjoyed it, which didn't seem to be right. They were monogamous when they enjoyed sex. That didn't seem to be right. When they came to talk about marriage and what it was about, it was just completely different. Why did you get married? Well, because I was an adult. Strange reason, isn't it? And so what was the purpose? Well, I wanted a family. I wanted to leave home, have my own family. So I got married. And so, well, why did you choose her? Why did you choose him? Well, they were clean. They were industrious. Our family knew their family. They just lived around the corner. She knitted and she kept her own clothes and things like that. He had a bath each Saturday and was respectable. That was the kind of reasons. What about their looks? Well, yeah, they look well. Yeah, what about them, you know? And what about romance? Ah, romance, no, that's stupid. That's something Hollywood invented in the 1940s. These people loved each other. They lived faithfully with happy sexual relationships through their life, but they didn't have any of the kind of thinking that is considered to be normal today. And that is only 100 years ago. That's what we're talking about. It's not even 100 years ago. It's 1918 onwards, although, yeah, it's not even 100 years ago that we're talking about. The difference can be seen in this cartoon. Yeah? How did you manage to stay together for 65 years? Well, we're from a time when if something is broken, we fix it, not throw it away. I love that cartoon. I've forgotten where I saw it somewhere. You know, Google gave it to me or something, but it's a wonderful thing, the shift in our focus, in a shift in our understanding. Even the idea that you'd make your own clothes, that would be a high point of your attraction to the neighbour. I mean, clothes are so cheap today because of slave labour and because our unions are only nationalised, not internationalised. Because of it, we have these incredibly cheap clothes. Why do you stitch up anything? It's ridiculous. Throw it away, buy a new one. Such is the nature of our wealth. And as with our clothes, as with everything else in our life. So this is my summary of what happened through the course of the century. My summary, but I think it's right, of course, otherwise I wouldn't use it. But back in the First World War, in the kind of First World War generation, I'll call them, in order to become an adult, you wanted a family, and because you wanted a family, you got married, and when you got married, you had sex in order to have kids, and in order to have grandkids. I'd say children rather than kids, but it doesn't fit on the overhead so easily. Their children, though, were the Second World War children, and they had a different view. They were caught up with romance because the picture theatre had come into prominence at that point. And as a result of falling in love, you got married. As a result of having married, you had sex. As a result of that, you had kids, and so a family, and so grandkids. But notice that first reason of just growing up has gone. Notice you don't start with wanting a family, you start with falling in love. Their children were the baby boomers. And the baby boomers, oh, at this point you hiss, at the baby boomers from 1965 onwards, their view was different. Yes, there was romance, but romance didn't lead to marriage, romance led to sex. The reason they got married was to have sex. It was all just pure to have sex. And if you had marriage and sex, well, you had kids and divorce and a grand dog. Because you taught your children that marriage wasn't worth having and children was a big mistake, you see. And so I was out the other night with some baby boomers, with three couples of baby boomers. My wife and I, we're just a little bit older than baby boomers. We were born just in the last year of the war, Helen and I. But they are baby boomers. We have 13 grandchildren. These three couples have one grandchild between the three of them. They all had children. They had more children than we did. They don't have grandchildren. Because none of their children, well, one of them, none of the children are married. Four children, not one married. We had three children, all married, all got kids. Different worldview, you see, is operating here. And often I meet baby boomers, they really don't like it. Well, of course, what happens to their children is sex is all that matters. By the way, the baby boomers married at the average age of 21 for males, 19 for females. Sex was the reason. That's what it was all about, was sex, you see, which is why they had such high divorce rates and the rest, and why kids were so unimportant to them ultimately in the way they raised them. So their children, sex was all that mattered. And then you may fall in love as a result of having sex. You live in de facto relationships until you have kids. And so you then turn it into a legal marriage, de jure marriage, which of course has a very high rate of divorce. And the more you live in de facto relationships, the higher the percentage of divorces that you have. The de facto marriage has become a very prominent factor. Some of course have got rid of that. With the sex and driving to romance and de facto, the kids became later in life. So today, the average age of kind of marriage for the non-Christian, early 30s. Christians, back in the days of the baby boomers, people like me, we got married around 25. We were thought to be really weird because everyone else was married, but we waited till we were 24, 25. Today, we're really weird because we get married so early and have kids. One of my daughters had her fourth child when she was 35, I think it was, something like that. And she was in the maternity ward where every other mother was having their first child, and she was one of the youngest mothers there. When they found that this was her fourth, they were astonished how early you'd have children. Ridiculous. And so it's just changed pattern like that. Well, the millennials, it's just pornography, sex, de factos and dogs. That's all that's available to you now, you see. Because that's what it is. You just hook up, you just link up with people, you just move from one person to another. De facto marriages are now 50% of marriages. And so what do you produce from de facto marriages? Well, just more dogs. Well, the beauty about having dogs is when you want an overseas trip, you're allowed to put them down and you can come back and buy another one. But they won't let you put down your children. Not yet, anyway. I'm sorry for the dog lovers amongst us who wouldn't put down their dogs, but that's actually, literally does happen. Now, not that commonly, I know. Although I can't understand why not. Now, our problem, yours and mine, is we live in two worlds. We're Australian Christians. If you're an Australian Christian, you're in the world of Australia, which is that kind of mess. If you're a Christian, you're trying to live in a world, the world are yet to come, the kingdom of heaven to which you have come. But this problem is as old as the New Testament. They were living in the two worlds in the New Testament. Colossians 1, 13, 14. Colossians 1, 13, 14, where he speaks of we've been transferred out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his beloved Son. I haven't read that, I've quoted it, and I've most likely got it wrong. He has delivered us from the domain of darkness, transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. We're already in the new kingdom. It's not just something that happens when we die, it's something that happens to us while we're alive here and now, but yet we've got to keep going on living in the here and now. And so how do you live in the two worlds? But the fundamental choice that we want to put before everybody, and I'll put it before you, lest you haven't made this choice yet yourself, is choose you whom this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. It's the choice as old as Joshua. You have to make that choice. Are you going to live like the Canaanites, or are you going to live as the people of God in the land of God? That was the choice that was before them. It's still the choice that lands before us, our friends. Are you going to live God's way, or are you going to live the world's way? For the choice is becoming clearer and clearer. See, when I was a young man, going to a school which was rustic and dirty and kind of crass, called Scots College. It was when I was there. We had bagpipes played all day, the whole way through school time. You either were tortured or you learned to like the bagpipes. It's the nature of life. You might say, well, this explains a lot about you, Philip, now that you understand that I was educated to the sound of bagpipes. But now I've totally lost in my own humour. I've lost what I was going to say about as young people. It was all confusing because our culture was Christianised. So you couldn't see the good and the bad because it was all muddled. Now it's not muddled. It's clearer and clearer. You're either going to live the way of the world or you're going to live the way of God. And on the sex subject, it's clearer than almost any other subject now because it was the sexual revolution that lay at the heart of the cultural revolution and the cultural wars that we've experienced through the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century. The fundamental choice is still there. It's a choice of giving up the way of the world to live the way of Christ, and therefore it's the call now as Christians to holiness. Now the word holiness does not mean purity. That's a consequent of holiness. The essence of holiness is separation, difference, distinctiveness, set aside, being allocated as specially for them, right? This is my watch. It is holy to Philip Jensen. It's not your watch, it's my watch. It's given to me, and it's for me, not for you. And so holiness has to do with this sense of being set aside for special purposes. In the Old Testament Canaanite religion, the temples were centres of prostitution, female and male prostitution. And the prostitutes at the temple were called the holy ones. You can't think of anything more unholy in our sense of purity than male and female prostitutes in a temple. That is about as degenerate as it goes. But they're the holy ones in the Bible because they're the ones who are set aside for special purposes. Degeneracy, but special purpose. So the concept of holiness, I use a very stark illustration to get your mind clear, that holiness is being set aside. We live differently to the world. That's what we're called upon to do, to be different. To be not like them, as Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount. John Stott, in his little book, Christian Counterculture, which is a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, says the key text is in chapter 6, verse 8. Do not be like them. That is it. Do not be like them. We are to be living differently. So this morning is living God's way. I'm on to the next talk, you see. So this basic choice of life between being self-determining, to go along with the world and the way of the world, or to be a creature responsible to your Creator. It's all about the way of living now. And part of the way of living now is the way we use our bodies now. To find out where we're to live under the Creator, of course, we need to go to the Creator's book. to guidance of his revelation found in the scriptures, and part of understanding this creation and our place in creation, and especially being made in the image of God to rule the world, has to do with being male and female, has to do with our marriage, has to do with our sexuality. But we've got to do it God's way, not our way. Guidance in the scriptures is more than a set of key proof texts. It's understanding the big plan that I spoke of yesterday and I've reminded you of again. Like you see in Romans 8, 28 to 30, Ephesians 1, 3 to 10, that incredibly long paragraph, the God's plan centered upon Christ, who is the image of the invisible God in Colossians 1, 15 to 20, where everything is to be united underneath him in order to make many of us brothers of the Lord Jesus Christ so that he will be glorified in everything. That is, he was making for himself a people, you find in Titus 2, a people of his own, zealots for good works. The word actually zealots, it's a noun, but all our translations talk about being zealous for, because we don't like anybody to be a zealot, because that's extremism, and religious extremism is evil. Any extremism has to be stopped in Australia. It is un-Australian to be a zealot, and therefore it's un-Australian to be a Christian. Grasp it, friends. The quicker you grasp it, the easier you'll be able to deal with the century that lies ahead of you. That we no longer are welcome in this nation, you need to understand, because the Lord Jesus Christ, through his apostle, taught us to be zealots. And I believe in extremism, because nearly everybody who has ever done anything good in the history of our culture was an extremist. William Wilberforce was an extremist. He was a zealot for good works, and I thank God for him, for what he did for the good of humanity. Zeal is a good thing when in the right direction, a bad thing when in the wrong direction. Paul was a zealot to destroy Christianity until he became a zealot to preach Christianity. What was right, what was wrong was not his zeal, but his object of his zeal. We are to be zealots for good works. That must be us. This big plan involves love, sex, and marriage. For from the beginning, woman was created for man, the bride for the bridegroom. And this is the church being made and united for Christ. So to understand this and the whole topic of LSM, we need to talk back about the concept of marriage. Now, I'm not talking about the wedding. I'm talking about marriage. A wedding is a celebration of the beginning of a relationship, or the forthcoming baby of a relationship that's been going for the last 5 years or something or else. It's a rip-off, a financial rip-off. One of my friends got engaged the other day. She went and tried to find out about wedding dresses and was shown dresses for $10,000. Complete and utter unethical absurdity. You do not need a $10,000 dress to get married in. In fact, a wedding, I've had people say, I can't afford to get married, which is nonsense. Cost you about $20 or $30 to get married, maximum. The wedding is just a complete rip-off of materialism. It's got nothing much to do with the reality. A wedding should be a contract, for that lies at the heart of marriage. The trouble is people want to have a contract without writing it, which is absurd and stupid. Would you buy a house without having a legal contract? Would you buy a car without a contract? Would you start a new job without a contract? But you're going to start the most, just putting it crudely, economically involving relationship that you're ever going to do without a contract. Well, you'll have a contract, it's just an unwritten one. And the unwritten one, you don't know the small print in the clauses, because it's unwritten, you haven't seen what it is yet. It is a complete absurdity. It is an immoral thing to impose it upon people or suggest it to people. Right? A prenuptial agreement is an appalling thing because it's already designed for divorce. But even that has more sense than the idea of just starting up this relationship and hoping it's going to work out somehow. That's a dreadful thing to do to people as our society, because it always has an implicit contract in it. Much better to have an explicit contract than an implicit. That's just wisdom, human wisdom. But marriage has got that contract, and what the wedding is about is formalising the contract, plus materialistic nonsense. And it's a good thing, but it's marriage. What is in the contract? What's it about? What is marriage about in the Old Testament and the New Testament? The first couple of chapters are really critical, because when Jesus is asked about marriage, he explains it in terms of Genesis 1 and 2. In Matthew chapter 19, he quotes Genesis 1 and 2. This is what marriage is about. So to recap, in Genesis 1, God created, verse 27, man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. That is, male and female together are in the image of God, because God created humanity. See why you need that word man? God created man, capital M man. And in capital M man, there's little M man and there's little W woman. Right? There is male and female that together make up man. That is humanity. It's like racism, friends. There is only one race. It's called the human race. That's why we don't like ethnic divisions, because that's ethnicism. Racism is Peter Singer, who wants to say that animals and humans are the same. That's racism. That's like it's a the human race is one, made male and female by God from the beginning. The language shift is an important part of undermining the philosophical concepts that the Bible has taught us for centuries. God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion. That is, God didn't create lots of humanities. He created one man, male and female, that through their reproduction, they would create one man, one humanity. There is only, there's a lovely book, One Blood, because evangelical Christians were the only people really in Australia who fought for Aboriginal rights through the 18th, 19th century. And our big claim was, they're all one blood with us. There's one humanity. We were the ones who stood defending the rights of Aborigines. The mission stations are all put down these days, but friends, learn the history of it. Learn about Mr. Threckold, who learnt Aboriginal languages back in the 1820s and taught them how to read and write back in their own languages, not our language, their own languages. Learn what actually the missionaries were doing. They were the ones who were defending the humanity of Aborigines. And in defending the humanity of Aborigines, they were ridiculed by the atheists who at that time were into eugenics and didn't believe they were fully human and were quite happy to send off their bodies to be investigated over in Europe and the rest of them. We were the ones who defended them and are now pilloried for our activities in the doing of it, because we believe there is one man. That's all there is, one man, and we are an extension of that one man. That one man, male and female, had us. And that is why we sinned when he sinned, because we were him and he is us. There's only one human. All humanity sinned in the sin of Adam. And so man in the garden was given the task of gardening, because he is to subdue the garden, and he could be seen not to be able to fulfill his mandate, because he alone could not do it. Of course he couldn't. He needed a woman in order to have marriage. I mean, the animals were not adequate, were not satisfactory as sexual partners, as those who with whom we could have children. But when he sees the woman at last, verse 23, that this is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man, and therefore man shall leave his father and mother, and immediately you see it all turns into sex. It all turns into marriage. Hold fast to his wife and they'll become one flesh, and the one and the man and wife were both naked and were unashamed. The creation of the woman was the creation of the woman for the man to complete the man, so that the man could complete his task of having children, so that one humanity could multiply and fill the earth and subdue the whole earth. Here's the basic idea of marriage then. It's a sexual union of a reproductive character, which is therefore of male and female, which takes takes precedence over all other human relationships, because you leave your parents to create the next brand of the family. The basic unit of humanity is 1 plus 1 equals 1. One male, one female equals one man. Men and women have been created as men and women, the same and yet different, in order to be united as one. It's a binary nature of humanity. That binary nature of humanity is not imaginary. It's not a social, cultural construct of gender. God made humanity with sexual polarity, male and female, for the purpose of reproductive unity, so that we will not have divisions in humanity, but one humanity, all related to each other, which is why death rips the fabric of our humanity, and divorce rips the fabric. We're supposed to be a big network, and then this part of the network splits, and parts start to fall away from other parts. Other things can be seen here. Gender differentiation is there. The male in his orientation to his work, the female in her orientation to relationships and reproduction, is reinforced in chapter 3, where the judgment falls upon the man in his work and the judgment falls upon the woman in her relationships. The very thing which is so important, reproduction, becomes a matter of great pain. The translation's wrong when it talks about pain in labour. I think the NIV has pain in labour. The word's not labour. It's in the whole reproductive process. It's the pain of having a period. It's the pain of having miscarriages. It's the pain of the stillbirth. It's the pain of menopause. It's the very part of that which is so different about women is now that which is so painful. So that we have a specialty, you see, lies not only in obstetrics, but the specialty actually is across the whole issue of women's medicine. So you'll have special hospitals for women that you don't have special hospitals for men. Because women's life now has been blighted in their very creation, in their very bodies, because of the sin of this world. And, of course, because of the wickedness of evil men, you get the whole domestic violence that is taking place, and which is only ever wicked. It's not always men. Sometimes the women are violent to the men. But that conflict is built into our sinful nature. But you see, the judgment of God falls upon women in her relationships as it falls upon man in his labour and work in Genesis 3. Creation is of a unity, and it is reinforced in the rest of the Old Testament. It's reinforced by giving the commandment, "You shall not commit adultery," because unity lies at the heart of having the children. And it's important that you do not. Sometimes it's the wisdom of living monogamously. Come across to Proverbs chapter 3. The newspapers never seem to understand this. The whole issue of domestic violence is loud and clear in our society. It should have been a long time ago, of course, but loud and clear in our society at the moment. But go to Proverbs chapter 3 and you'll understand something of why. Proverbs 6. You'll understand something of why it is so. He says in Proverbs 6:30, "People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his appetite when he is hungry." 31, "But if he is caught, he will pay sevenfold. He will give all the goods of his house. He who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. He will get wounds and dishonor, and his disgrace will not be wiped away. For jealousy makes a man furious, and he will not spare when he takes revenge. He will accept no compensation. He will refuse though you multiply gifts." See, theft is bad, but you can compensate for it. But steal a man's wife, his revenge will know no end. You watch the domestic violence issues, and over again, that lies at the background of it. That doesn't excuse it. That doesn't make it right. I'm not for a moment suggesting that it's all right, but I'm just saying we're playing with fire. You must understand the nature of the fire. When people are united in marriage or in sexual relationships, a new element arises, a new power comes into the relationship, which is far in excess of rationality. And if you think you're going to get a rational response and explanation from people when it is broken, Well, you're a very silly person, because it is a profound union that God makes them one. That is what is being said by the Lord Jesus Christ himself. And that is, the unity is expressed in the covenant of faithfulness. So I read to you Malachi chapter 2 yesterday, and it's seen especially in the covenant made between God and Israel. Faithfulness lies at the heart. The picture is established by the negative. The innumerable examples of sinfulness, often without comment. You see, David's family, if you read through the events of David, oh, what a mess he made, because he couldn't keep his pants on. Faithfulness undoes marriage, especially sexual unfaithfulness, because marriage is built on the unity of the flesh, promised in the covenant. Remember, see, Hollywood always gets it wrong, doesn't it? At the wedding service, they always say, I do. When the wedding service, you're supposed to say, I will. Not, do you love her? Will you love her? Very different question. Hollywood never gets it. But when the woman's just spent all that money and time with her $10,000 dress and walks down the aisle, every man in the room loves her. You know, do you love her? 30 men rise up, say, I do. A stupid idea. The question is, when she's not in the $10,000 dress, when she hasn't spent all morning in the beauty parlour, when she's 64, when she's wrinkly and old, will you love her? That is the nature of it. We're making a promise for the future, not a statement of our present emotional state. The world doesn't understand it. Hollywood doesn't understand it. But we need to, because faithfulness is the essence of marriage. Love is not the essence of marriage. Faithfulness is. The husband is to love his wife. The wife's not called upon to love her husband. That's not what the Bible is teaching. Now, the older women are to teach the younger women to love their husbands. Different word, love, at that moment, although the difference is not always as great as people make out between words. But the husband must love his wife. He's required to love his wife. It's laid upon him that he will love his wife. But both husband and wife must be faithful to the promises they make to each other. They must be faithful to each other, because they are to be faithful to God. It's all got to do with faithfulness, covenant, and history. Read my article on Facebook. So, very important article. It's actually picking up somebody else's idea. That's why it's so good. So, you come to Malachi chapter 2, you see, God is our witness. For God's purpose in creation of us as one is to make us able to reproduce godly offspring. So again, you see, divorce goes right against the very heart of what the marriage is about, because the marriage is about unity for godly offspring. Divorce is about leaving and not caring about the offspring in the end. That is, in the Old Testament, love is not the explicit glue of marriage. Faithfulness to our sexual union, to our covenant promises, to the context of child raising, faithfulness is the clue. Yeah, just pick it up in the current debates about marriage. These people love each other, why shouldn't they marry? The misunderstanding is not about heterosexual, homosexual. The misunderstanding is about what marriage is about. Complete misunderstanding of it. Reinforced by Christians, I'm sorry to say, because when you move into the New Testament, the picture has not changed from the Old Testament. Jesus rejects the Pharisees' attempt to use Moses in order to justify serialized monogamy. Jesus keeps turning back to Genesis 2 and Genesis 1 to understand marriage. You'll find it in Matthew 19. Jesus sees marriage as God making us one, and divorce as man unmaking us. Now, this is an area of holiness. So, let me finish by going to 1 Corinthians 7. So, the reasons for marriage, that'll come tomorrow. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 7 and look at what this great passage teaches us about marriage. There are some serious mistranslations. They're in nearly all the translations, so if I haven't checked the Holman, might be better. It's eccentric, so you can't be sure. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. It's not saying good for a man, Yeah, that translates. But because of temptation, the word temptation is actually not there in the text, because of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Paul is writing to a church where sexual immorality is already well established. You'll see it in chapter 6, the immediate context of it. And he's saying, because of sexual immorality, it's better to be married. Marriage has to do with avoiding sexual immorality. That's part of the purpose of marriage as opposed to sex. And so, some would say, well then, men and women shouldn't even touch each other, shouldn't have any sex. He said, no. Marriage is the antidote, not abstinence. Marriage is the antidote. And he goes on to talk about the husband and the wife giving each other their conjugal rights and never denying each other. Wonderful passage here. Feminists think that they invented sex amongst women, but actually you read here, and Paul understood that women had sexual needs right there in that paragraph. It's as old as Paul, and God made it up, so he knows. Now, he says this, verse 6, having sex with each other frequently and rarely as married people. Now, I say as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself, but each has his own gift from God, one of a kind, one of another. To the unmarried and to the widows, I say that it's good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, the word cannot is wrong. Get rid of it, cross it out. If they are not exercising self-control, he's talking to people who are already sexually immoral. We need this passage translated properly for the 21st century. Because we're not talking about people who cannot exercise self-control. We're talking about people who are already not exercising self-control. If they're already having sex with each other, what should they do? They should marry. That's what they should do. That's what he says to do. They should marry. For it's better to marry than go to hell, burn with passion. It's not about your internal passion problem. This is how I used to read it. If you listen to any of my early sermons, I've got it wrong. This is now what I've come to understand is what the scripture is actually saying. Publicly criticised in a book on the subject for getting it wrong. And he was right, I was wrong, and I'm glad to correct it, you see, that the Greek is actually saying these people are already Christians, but they're already having sex with each other and they're not married. Get married. That's what it's talking about. And then he goes on to talk to the married, you shouldn't separate. If you do, stay single. If you can't stay single, get back together again. Because the word divorce shouldn't be there in verse 11. In modern English, the word divorce means free to marry somebody else. The word here is free to be separate. It's a different word. Separation, that may be the case. But divorce, freedom to remarry, that is not what he's talking about. The passage goes on in verse 16, talking about sex within marriage. At verse 17-25, has a little section about contentment, which doesn't mention sex or marriage or anything in that passage. And it's like 1 Corinthians 12-14. Chapter 12, he talks about the gifts. Chapter 14, he's talking about edifying the church. Chapter 13, there is this passage on love. It's the love passage which is key to understand chapter 12 and 14. Well, likewise, this paragraph about contentment is the understanding of sex in marriage and marriage. Because from 25 through to 39, he's now talking about single people, the virgin, and whether to marry or not. And so the question of being single or being married is discussed in the last third of the chapter, having introduced the concept of contentment. He introduces into that also the concept of the eschaton, the fact the world's coming to an end, and in view of the world coming to an end, you may choose to remain single. And in getting married, you take upon yourself other responsibilities that don't enable you to give yourself as wholeheartedly to the Lord as somebody who is single. And so it's an argument for remaining single for the cause of the ministry of the gospel. But you do not remain single because it is a better spiritual state. It's just got practical advantages to it, which he has got and which he'd commend to you. And we should consider, friends, because we Christians tend towards a heresy called Mariolatry. It's not Mariolatry, it's got an extra R. Mariolatry. That my life is not complete unless I'm married. Whereas we've got to learn contentment. Verses 17 through to 24. And it may be that we need to take hold of the advantages of singleness for the cause of the gospel. But if we do marry, we're doing nothing wrong. And if we're betrothed to somebody and she's getting old and beyond the years of having children, we should marry her. Because, see, the Bible's realistic. Marriage is about having children. And you wait till you're 45, you're not going to have children. Whereas our society is, go and make your career first, and then when you're 40, we'll do something medically for you that will enable you to have children. Poor children raised by geriatrics. It's a dreadful thing. So, my friends, have your children young. If you're going to get married young, have your children, and then when they're off your hands in old age, you can get on with the work of the Lord. But in the meantime, knowing that entering into marriage is going to be a major distraction from your public ministry. My sisters, you need to hear it. I know everybody wants to tell you can do everything, you can have it all and all the rest of it, but it's a lie. You can't. The Governor General, the female Governor General we had, I can't think of her name, Queenslander, Quentin Bryce, 5 children, academic career, Governor General. She says, you can have it all, but you can't have it all at the same time. I like that. She's right. She had a family, and then when her family moved off her hands, she had her academic career, and then she moved on to being Governor General. But the idea that you can have it all in your lifetime, all at the same time, is a complete lie. And the age to be having your children is before, start having your children is before 30, according to the medical fraternity. You just need to face reality. God has created you as a woman. Praise God, that's wonderful. Every man in the room is glad. Like Adam was. And you, my sister, should be glad, because that is exactly what the Sovereign Lord wanted for you. So rejoice and be glad and take hold of what it means to be a woman and be one to the praise and glory of the Lord Jesus Christ. And men, they live a much harder life than we do. You be kind, you be gentle, you be sacrificial in your care of your sisters, because their life is considerably more difficult. Our problems lie in our work. Their problems lie in their very being. But for all of us, friends, when you sin sexually, it's like any other sin, he says in 1 Corinthians 6. You sin against your own body. Every other sin is external to me, but sexual sins is me. So it is much more profound than anything else in the area of sin that we will deal with. Which is why we need to look at holiness tomorrow.